Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Janine. I am delighted to have you back on the Fundraising Talent, not for the first, not for the second, but the third time. And for a number of reasons, technical glitches, we have not been able to broadcast the first couple of conversations. So we're inviting you back and we're going to have a great conversation today. But before we do that, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, thank you, Jason. My name is Janine Triplett, and I am currently the Chief Development and Communications Officer for the Girl Scouts Kentuckiana, and I have worked in fundraising and communications my entire life. So it's been probably 30 years with vast experience working in grant writing, special events, donor relations, you name it, sort of everything.
Yeah. So anybody who listens, is a regular listener to the podcast, knows that anyone who says they've been around as long as perhaps you and I have, I always ask the question, sort of, what does fundraising look like now compared to what it looked like then?
Well, I think it's just the one of the reasons I love fundraising is not only connecting with the donors, but no 2 days are ever the same. So I think now more than ever, that is the case. I would probably venture to be safe to say no hours to ever to not the same. So I'd say in the last 10 years, you've seen, because I do communications and fundraising, I think you've seen such a more of a merger of those two disciplines come together, and they're more important than ever, especially with peer-to-peer fundraising, digital media, digital advertising. We have the challenge now more than ever that we have so many different channels and opportunities to connect with donors, connect with those interested in our mission. And the challenge is how do you continue to try to get the message to so many different generations and so many different donors with backgrounds? So I think that's the biggest thing is change. We have a tremendous amount of opportunities. It's also hard, especially if you have a small shop, right? How to really focus in on what you should do first.
Yeah. Now, before we dive into our topic, I have had representatives of the Girl Scouts on the podcast before, and I really appreciate providing my listeners with the clarification that I've come to understand. I've always been a champion of Scouts, and in particular, the Girl Scouts. My mother was involved with Scouts. My sister was involved with Scouts. Can you explain how the, oftentimes we misunderstand what the what the cookies mean to Girl Scouts, and that in fact it's not understood as a fundraising strategy per se, but it actually is much more understood as a entrepreneur. I'm probably not putting the right words together, but it's much more understood as sort of an entrepreneurial venture for the girls. Am I right? Yeah. Something of that sort?
Yes, you are. And actually, I was going to say, as you were talking, you're not too far off base. We have someone locally who's a dean of one of the business schools where I live, and she and the entrepreneurial program, they have a really strong entrepreneurial program. And when she speaks about the one thing she learned that made an impact on her career and what she does now for a living, it was selling Girl Scout cookies, because it is about the Girl Scouts is the largest organization in the United States, leadership organization for young girls. So everything has a purpose, right? Every badge, every program, at the end result, teaching them mostly building on what they learn in school, but just those extra things that they don't teach in school. And cookies is one of them. So each troop gets to plan how they sell the cookies, what they do with the profits, how they spend the profits. It's not unusual for one of our troops to take a trip to Savannah, Georgia during non-COVID times, but still, yes. You know, but they decide from start to the finish how they're going to sell their cookies and where they're going to sell them and how do they market them. And so it really is, and it's girl-led. It really is. The parents support it, but it should be good girl-led.
Okay, so you said Savannah. So my wife and I met and married in Savannah. And so you can't say Savannah on my podcast without explaining to our listeners why Savannah means so much to the Girl Scouts.
That's true. I should have. It's the mothership, so to speak.
Right. It is the mothership
for Girl Scouts of the U.S. That's where Juliet Gordon Lowe, the founder of Girl Scouts,
yes,
is from. And that is where our headquarters is currently located, too. And not to mention, it's just an amazingly beautiful city. One of my favorites, too. So.
Yes, it's a beautiful city in the squares. I mean, my wife and I will get back. So we met and married in Savannah 21 years ago.
Yeah.
Married 21 years ago. Known each other a little bit longer than that. Went to college there. Certainly knew the downtown squares. I could show you exactly where the Juliet Gordon Lowe house is, as well as a number of other places. And so when someone says Savannah, it is a beautiful city. So, Janine, when you and I talked the first time, that recording got messed up, as sometimes technology does to us. And we even tried to record a second time and that didn't go really well. But what did we agree to talk about today?
Well, I think we wanted to talk about sort of to provide some advice to individuals maybe just starting out in their fundraising careers. I have noticed a trend over the years, and I'm sure you have noticed as well. I think when we were talking about earlier, what has changed in fundraising? Another thing has changed in fundraising that really does tie back to what I'm going to say is that now it's sort of a legitimate profession, right? I mean, you have the Indiana yes. University School of Philanthropy, there are degrees, there's career tracks. And I think when I started out, maybe when you started out, you just sort of, you didn't have a major, you sort of have a degree and you ended up in that job somehow because maybe you did a fundraiser in college. So you ended up, right, getting a fundraising job outside of college. So that's sort of how that works. But you really didn't have any training, or you didn't have, there wasn't a method to the madness so much. So now there's so many professional organizations and resources like what we're doing today. There's so much advice. So going into the career right now, it is a really good time to do it. I think sometimes, though, individuals that are coming out of college or in their first job, our development professionals don't last sometimes longer than 2 or 3 years in a job. And I think there's a lot to be said for maybe providing advice on how to work on a longevity in a career. And I think that's sometimes hard in fundraising.
And I would not have read this book when you and I first recorded this conversation. So it's kind of cool that I just finished this book. But I just read David Epstein's book, Range. The subtitle is Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. And it's the idea What Epstein is getting at is the idea that too often in some fields, and I certainly think this is the case for fundraising, and this somebody was asking for advice on LinkedIn yesterday on this same question, this idea of what do we do with young fundraising professionals and how do we make sure that they sort of get it right? And what Epstein argues is that too many of us, oftentimes in different professions, get caught up in what he calls early specialization. Mm-hmm. So we become specialists too early. And if there's anything that I think fundraising is suffering from, you know, so if you and I, two individuals who've spent multiple decades in fundraising, if you and I were sitting at a table with a group of young people who are just, you know, 6 months into their fundraising career, I think my advice would be do not invest in early specialization, which is to say, do not get overly invested in direct response, special events, grant writing, major gifts. Don't peg yourself, don't pigeonhole yourself in a particular sort of specialty until you've truly experienced sort of broader range. And that may mean you're going to have to sort of seek out employment opportunities that'll sort of give you that that range, that's the name of the book, Epstein's book, that range of experiences. What's your thoughts on that?
I would agree wholeheartedly. I don't know, and especially if they're going to, and that's going to be more problematic, you're right. The larger the organization, the more development staff they often will have, such as a university. And so you will easily get pinholed into a position if that's what you want. But if that happens, you can always, too, look for volunteer opportunities to work with nonprofits and other areas that are not a conflict of interest to what you're doing. So anytime you work in a small shop, though, or a smaller nonprofit, you will benefit from. I don't know of anyone that, especially now, it's still the same. Every smaller nonprofit has, usually when you're one of those positions, you're wearing lots of hats. And I enjoy that. So if I like working in different areas, and some people maybe don't, but I agree. The more experience you can get, in the long run, it will be better for your career.
Yeah.
Part of the advice that I would be giving to that young person is perhaps the idea that we need to ensure younger people opportunities to be in front of the donor earlier in their career. I think too many of us, and this is sort of where the specialization I think becomes very detrimental also, is that a lot of these fundraising methods that afford specialization and generally are pretty, you know, we can put them to work really quickly. I think that's part of the reason why a lot of fundraisers get hired so quickly is because we use these specialized techniques. If you know them, we can use them and we can put them to work. But I think what ends up happening is that somebody ends up 5 years into their career, they might even secure their CFRE or some other credential, but they haven't spent a lot of meaningful time sitting across the lunch table with a donor.
Yes, I have.
That?
And I think that's one of the, in our current way of life with quick media, everything's quick. And you know, that part of the fundraising is more transactional, and it's not the same as cultivation, right? So I think we've had some conversations with individuals coming into fundraising for the first time need to understand when there's a part of it that is transactional, and you need to determine what that is and what that means to your organization. But then there's a part of it that's foundational base with, you have to know your donors. You have to meet with your donors. You have to have that one-on-one contact. Whenever that cultivation looks like, and I think there's any more an impatience for that. But as you know, it could take one time. I received a $2 million gift, and it was took a village, or about 5 to 6 years of cultivation for that gift. And it took a lot of different strategies, and patience is a key part of that. So sometimes anymore, people are like, well, they didn't respond to my email. I'm like, okay. It's like, well,
it's interesting. It's very interesting that you just said 5 or 6 years, because I was talking to my colleague this morning, and we were talking about the process that we teach in our, so in our seminar, we teach this process that moves from oftentimes the initial gift, oftentimes is a relatively trivial gift, to a more meaningful commitment that oftentimes is sort of that gift that we would sort of assume you receive perhaps a year in or two with more meaningful engagement with the organization. But oftentimes, I think all of us sort of, especially those of us been around a while, we know it takes 5, 6, sometimes 7 years before you even get to the place where you're securing some of those most significant gifts. If you sort of, it sounds like you certainly absorbed that as well.
Oh, yeah. And then it's just, as I've learned more and more, and you know this too, it's just all about relationship building. And, you know, it's the same thing, you know, if you go with your relationships being built on social media, then they're going to be very, you can tell a lot from people on social media, but then there's a lot you don't know. It's very surfacey, but it's, you know, you have to dig in and really get to know those people and make those calls. And I do think one of the things, I know a lot of nonprofits, and you've probably discussed this, the one thing the pandemic has done is given development professionals opportunity to call their donors. I have a colleague who is is a development professional at one of the colleges down in Alabama. It's a small college, small liberal arts college. And we were talking a month into the pandemic. I said, well, how's this affecting your work? She goes, well, I tell you, my donors are home and it's been wonderful because we've just been calling them and touching base with them to say, hello, how you doing? We just want to see how you're doing. And that was it. And so I think the pandemic has given, I hope people are using that opportunity. I know we certainly have at our Girl Scout Council. We made a point during the summer to call a huge group of donors over the summer. And so many of them were I heard back from our CEO that someone talked to someone and said, the Girl Scouts called to check on me. So I just can't say enough of that. And that is counterintuitive to our current way of thinking sometimes now with everyone wants it quick, they want a quick answer, they got to get, you know, and it just, that part of fundraising is the most, you need patience, right? You just have to have that patience. So,
yeah, I had a major donor. I'm sure the major donor, it's funny you use the word patience, because I had a major donor once tell me, he described the way I was working as patient and persistent. And I don't know that I had ever been told that before. And I don't know that I've perhaps even been told that since then, but it's an interesting sort of blend of characteristics. Someone who knows how to be persistent, which means you're not going away, which means you know how to sort of time your engagement, but also to get credit with being patient. Because I can think of some of the development officers that I've coached as employees, and I mean, goodness gracious, even if they got the point that it was going to take multiple touches, which is kind of this thing that we like to talk about. You know, it takes so many touches to do this or so many touches to do that. But at the same time, there's a patience that has to happen between each of those touches that I don't know that we've sort of developed. It's almost like you kind of wonder if these people have enough work on their plate because they're constantly touching and they're not patiently waiting and sort of giving the relationship some breathing room, yes. I guess you could say. It's like what we talk about in design work when we talk about, you know, designing something on paper, you give it the white space. I mean, isn't there a necessity? I have never thought about it. Isn't there a necessity for white space in sometimes our relationships?
Yes, I think so. And I think one thing too, that I have learned over the years is that, you know, you go into, You have to be ready for surprises in fundraising and adjust accordingly and be flexible too. So that's important to patience, because how many times have we all mapped out a capital campaign, and we think we know the donors, and we think, well, you know, Joe Smith, this will be an ideal ask for him, and we just know this is what he's passionate about. And then you actually get into a meeting with him and he's like, well, no, I don't want to fund the library, but I sure want to do the art room, right? My wife's passionate about art, and you know, that's really where my passion is. And so sometimes I think it's better to just, you've got to get to know the donor and listen to, you'll learn a lot when you get into a donor visit about what's important to them. And then you have to just adjust accordingly. And that happens all the time.
So what are the Girl Scouts doing? I think the first time you and I talked, we perhaps talked about some of the idea of using Zoom and getting back on the telephone. And I'm honestly hearing that quite a bit, that people are, you know, the development officers are fortunately getting more confident on the telephone, because that you want that more meaningful engagement, and we've got a little bit more of a margin on our time, and the donors are more responsive to, you know, inclined to pick up the telephone and have a meaningful conversation. But what are the other things that sort of an organization like the Girl Scouts that sort of has big, you got to have a big corporate structure, and you've got mm-hmm. local organizations and that sort of stuff. What's an organization of your size sort of talking about in the midst of COVID-19?
Well, I think for us, it's how to reach out for an organization that's really based on a school structure to form troops and to recruit new members. This has really been a challenge for us from a membership standpoint. Yeah. So especially, I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, and our public schools still have not gone back. The Jefferson County public schools have still not met in person. They're still doing remote learning. Now, some of the schools outside our county are meeting in a hybrid. A lot of the private schools outside our county are doing a hybrid. So they're just, all the schools, like anywhere in the United States, are all over the place. It's really, it's hard for our membership team to reach school officials. And so they're just really trying to be creative on how to reach, you know, we've been doing some drive-by events here at our council. We had a drive-by event a few Saturdays ago to help promote one of our programs. And we had over 100 cars show up for it, because girls still want to do Girl Scouts, but we had to come up with some like drive-by events, right? And some creative things to meet in the parking lot. And we're doing social distancing. We have camps. So we had to change sort of the way we do our camps. And people can come to camps and family, but we can't have programs. So we're just constantly day by day shifting and adjusting and trying to see what's working. And we still have had girls join Girl Scouts, it's hard, and it's just, but they've been doing a great job, and our program staff continues to do some online programming. And I don't know if we talked the last time, but I know during the summer we had to cancel our resident camp, and so as a result we did something called Camp in a Box. So they had a virtual program that you registered for, and our camp director worked with the girls on Zoom about, you know, okay, you're not at camp, but when you get to camp, these are the things you need to know, and these are the tools you use, and this is what you need to, you know, even though they're not at camp, it's still a camp education process. And we sent the girls Camp in a Box, and one of our foundations sponsored that. So it's been frantic and crazy, but we're making it work, like everyone, right? So,
okay, Janine. So here's the elephant in the room with a guy. I've got two boys and two girls, and I've been a big fan of the Boy Scouts. My boys were involved with Scouts, but what is it? And I'm married to a woman who's basically turned me into a feminist, and I don't come from those sort of roots. So what is it? I don't want to pick on the Boy Scouts, but what I do want to know is, what is it about the Girl Scouts that just seemingly keeps them out of trouble? Because they as an organization have just, when I think about my own involvement in Scouts, my boys' involvement in Scouts and stuff, I just seem to, and when I think about the Girl Scouts, you've just made, there's something about your organization, there's something about, I don't know, your values or something that keeps you all out of trouble.
Well, you know, that? I've thought about that too. I have experience working with several single-sex organizations. So I come from a background of attending an all-female school, worked in an all-female school, I've been involved with many organizations that are single-sex. I think the difference, and this is my personal opinion, and this is not reflecting any gender negatively, male at all. And just knowing my husband, and my father-in-law, bless his heart, he passed away, but he was a lifelong Boy Scout. I think he won the Beaver Award. Is that the outstanding volunteer? I mean, he was very proud. So the day he died, and his
My boys would. Oh, my boys.
So he went every Saturday. He in his 70s, he still had his Boy Scout uniform on, and he didn't even have grandchildren, but he still volunteered for the Boy Scouts. My impression of the two organizations over time, and I think this is a reflective of the of women's organizations first, men. We're a lot more hands on, and sometimes I think some of the men I've known at other organizations, like, oh, you are too controlling. You're too controlling. But somewhere along the way, where we really provide the structure and requirements for our volunteers and our leaders, while to some that might have seen a little too controlling, I think over the years it's what has helped us. Where I think we probably had background checks before there were background checks. We probably had a real strong structure for what. You know, we've always had requirements on, even before all this became a thing, on you cannot take a troop out without two adults. You know, we've always had these structures in place. And I really do think that's probably what has helped. I'm guessing maybe the Boy Scouts over the years have, now they're probably not now, but over the years, some of the years past, they probably were just very autonomous. And, you know, you took your troop and you did whatever you wanted to with them. And for some, it worked out fine. So I think that structure and cultural differences probably played into it somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but I like I said at the beginning of the recording, my mother and my sister was involved with Scouts when I was a kid. In fact, I oftentimes, and I'm not kidding, I went to Girl Scout camp before I went to Boy Scout camp, because I went with my mother. She was the camp cook. And so my first scout camping experience was at Scoutshire Woods in the southern part of Alabama. And that's where I went to camp. So that was my first camp experience. And we cherish that as a family. We certainly cherish that memory. But there's something about that. And I think there's also something about the sort of the nurturing nature of perhaps mothers or something. Yeah. Oftentimes say, and Janine, well, we can sort of wrap up on this thought. But, you know, one of the things that I think perhaps Girl Scouts, I have to imagine this sort of informs your fundraising philosophies. I have oftentimes said that I think women are perhaps better at the maybe it's just the feminine. Let's say it this way. The feminine side of all of us. We can say it that way. My wife would tell me that I have a feminine side. It's the feminine side of all of us that is perhaps better suited for fundraising, because it does lean into that sort of that nurturing and that cultivation of the relationship that ultimately delivers on those most meaningful gifts. And so it may be that an organization like yours, because you fundamentally are a feminist organization, you're advocating for women and all of the characteristics that a woman sort of brings to the table, you've got to be pretty good at fundraising. So do you think that really informs, that has to inform?
I think so too. And I think that, you know, female intuition, and you're right, the nurturing part. I am sure that over the years, especially in the nurturing part, has been a benefit to our organization for lots of reasons. But I agree with you. I agree with you in terms of, I think when we talked about the cultivation of a donor and the long-term, how to understand the long-term relationship with them, and even recognizing, identify small pieces of time that, I guess, you know, tying a donor, their whole background together, and recognizing things about donors, I think that's a real strength. That's something a female can do and do it well. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm working on this book. I'm working on this book project. The book will come out in 2021. And I keep running into sort of the more feminine side of our thinking tends to be much less linear and much more complex and okay with messiness. And if you think about sort of when I think about growing up as a child and the relationship I had with my two parents, wonderful parents, they were great. But it was my mother who was always much more patient and okay with the messiness and the unpredictableness of what it means to raise children. And perhaps that even has to do with some of the benefit of having structure, as you're saying, that the organization sort of benefits from. Once you create that structure, you say that it may be that the Girl Scouts have this structure. Once you create that structure, you can therefore become more tolerant of sort of the messiness that inevitably sort of happens within that, framework.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Janine, I have really enjoyed this conversation. I apologize that it took us three times, but three times is a charm. It looks like we've, I think this conversation has been great. And I feel like we have advocated for the Scouts here these year end episodes here as we're wrapping up 2020, looking to the new year. If somebody is anxious to, they know how to find me, but perhaps they're anxious to reach out to you and continue a conversation, how would you suggest
that they
do that?
They can find me on LinkedIn. It's Janine Triplett and Just Girl Scouts Kentuckiana. And our face and then also our website, but I'm on LinkedIn.
Okay. I will put a link in the show notes to Janine and to our listeners. Thank you for listening.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.